With Julie Tepish for another Bay Area warm traffic update.
Yes, over in Hayward, they should be clearing that wreck out of the left lane of northbound 880 after Whipple Road. So pretty slow from Alvarado Niles. Out in Oakland, there's a crash involving a car and a big rig. Westbound 580 is before the 80 interchange. Both should be on the right-hand shoulder. And the Caltrans sweepers are rolling on the Nimitz northbound 880 before 5th Embarcadero. You'll see them in the right lane and pretty sluggish traffic from Hagenberger Road. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Afternoon traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, offering the all-electric Kia EV6 with up to 320 horsepower and an EPA estimated range of 310 miles. More at kia.com. Good afternoon, I'm Dave Freeman. You're listening to KQED FM 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI FM 89.3 North Island, Sacramento. Live online at kqed.org. 1 o'clock.
Even though we're used to the heat, we're not used to this type of heat. So constant and so extreme.
It's only early June and scorching temperatures are already upending life in the western U.S.
10 million people are under excessive heat warnings.
For Wednesday, June 5th, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, what this first big heat wave means for the cost of air conditioning.
I've been here when it climbed to 118. I was so ill from the heat, I wouldn't even go out anymore.
Also, how is a decades-old federal program designed to fight poverty now trapping people in it?
They come to me several years later and say, ooh, you owe $20,000.
Plus, Eleanor Beardsley reports from the beaches of Normandy.
World leaders and the last living World War II vets are gathering for the 80th anniversary of D-Day.
That's coming up right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Hunter Biden's exes are among the latest witnesses to testify about his history of drug addiction. The president's son, who maintains he's in recovery, is on trial in Delaware for federal gun charges and could face up to 25 years in prison if convicted. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports on today's testimony.
Hunter Biden's ex-wife, Kathleen Buell, was on the stand less than a half hour. She told jurors she found his crack pipes and drug paraphernalia at their home and in his car. His ex-girlfriend, Zoe Kesten, told jurors she met Hunter in a gentleman's club in Manhattan in December 2017. She says they spent days together in hotel rooms where he was smoking crack every 20 minutes. Jurors were shown a photo from this time of Hunter in a bubble bath and holding a crack pipe. Kesten described witnessing Hunter buy crack cocaine and also trying to cook it himself. But she said despite his addiction, Hunter remained functional and charming. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, outside the federal courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware.
Meanwhile, House Republicans have issued criminal referrals against both the president's son and his brother, James Biden. They're recommending the pair be charged with making false statements to Congress. The American Civil Liberties Union says it will sue the Biden administration over tighter limits at the southern U.S. border. Under an executive order, asylum seekers who cross into the U.S. illegally can be turned away when migrant crossings have surpassed a daily threshold. ACLU attorney Lee Gullert tells NPR the policy runs afoul of a legal process.
You cannot limit asylum depending on where people enter. What this does is say if you enter between ports, you're not going to be screened for asylum. And what Congress and international law have been very clear about is if you get to U.S. soil, you have to be given a screening for danger for asylum.
Biden's executive action sets the cap at a seven-day average of 2,500 migrants per day. In recent weeks, the number of unauthorized crossings at the southern border has averaged 3,700 a day. In less than 24 hours, the International Space Station is expected to finally receive the Starliner. After two prior failed attempts, Boeing's commercially built capsule took off this morning from Florida, strapped to an Atlas V rocket, and for the first time, two astronauts are on board.
25.
Status check. Go Atlas. Go Centaur. Go Starliner. Godspeed, Butch and Sonny.
Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams will spend about a week on the orbiting outpost, and if all goes as planned, NASA is expected to certify Starliner as a second means, in addition to SpaceX, of routinely launching astronauts to ISS. U.S. stocks end the day higher. The Nasdaq closed up 330 points, or nearly 2%. The NASDAQ was up, or S&P was up 1.1%. It's NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Levels of COVID in Bay Area wastewater are continuing to rise as this year's summer swell appears to be arriving early. KQED's Carly Severn has more.
Stanford's wastewater scan team says COVID numbers are up at 82% of the sites they monitor locally, mirroring an upward trend nationally. Across the country, COVID wastewater levels are now in the high category. COVID levels are especially pronounced in San Francisco's two wastewater sites, where the Stanford team says it's seeing some of the highest concentrations it's ever measured. Last year, the seasonal summer swell didn't start until late June. People 65 and older remain eligible for an extra vaccine dose this summer. However, only 36% of this age group in California are up to date on their vaccines. I'm Carly Severn, KQED News.
A new free food pantry designed to resemble a grocery store opens today in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point. Local nonprofits are referring qualifying low-income residents to the new District 10 community market. That referral allows residents to shop at the market and take the food they like. Maggie Sugarman, the market's director, says food banks often give out pre-made packages of food that include items people may not want.
Really, our focus here is about dignity and choice. There are a lot of models of giving out food to people, but there's not a lot that really focus on the client and their experience and their autonomy when it comes to making choices about what they feed themselves and their families.
The market will be open 2 days a week starting next week. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Afternoon support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners and members of KQED. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Main Library, presenting Ralph Chazet, A San Francisco Century, The Untold Story of the Renaissance Man, Coit Tower Muralist and Father of the Children's Program, Brother Buzz. SFPL.org to plan your visit. Visiting outside, take care. Warm to hot today. Bay Area, low 70s near the water, with low 100s far inland today. San Francisco, up to 80. Some are saying it's actually warmer than that right now. Officially 85 today in Oakland, 100 in Concord.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The first big heat wave of the season is bearing down on the western United States. Now, we are still more than 2 weeks away from the official start of summer, and these increased temperatures have a real impact on daily life. In a moment, we'll hear how intense heat means higher cooling costs. First, though, NPR's Kirk Sigler reports that more than 10 million people are under excessive heat warnings in Arizona, Nevada, and parts of California until the weekend. It's the result of a heat dome where high pressure pushes hot air down and causes temperatures to soar.
Climate scientists are warning this summer could be among the hottest on record, which is no surprise to Queen Anune. She's been preparing for extreme heat emergencies as the new deputy chief at Las Vegas Fire and Rescue.
We want everybody to, if you don't have to be outside, to stay inside in cooler temperatures.
Dangerously hot temperatures of up to 112 are forecast in Las Vegas and Phoenix, and 111 in Palm Springs. First responders are mobilizing to protect the homeless and elderly from potentially life-threatening heat exhaustion or heat stroke. Now, Vegas faces a particular challenge, Anune says, because there will still be lots of tourists out on the strip regardless of the extreme heat advisories. Donald Trump has also scheduled an outdoor rally there later this weekend.
And although we have air-conditioned casinos and hotels, we have a lot of sites for people to see. And so people are out more than they are normally when they're home.
The city is dispatching community paramedic teams that will also target vulnerable populations and get them to newly opened cooling centers. Extreme heat kills more people every year in the U.S. than any other extreme weather disaster, including wildfires or floods. Last year alone, Arizona's two most populous counties recorded more than 800 heat-related deaths.
Here in Arizona in general, like, we often hear that, oh, we're used to the heat. We are desert people.
Fatima Luna is Tucson's chief resilience officer, a new position focused on climate sustainability. She says many of the heat deaths are longtime Arizonans.
We have to change that narrative. Every single heat-related death is preventable.
This week, Tucson passed new heat ordinances that will give city workers more breaks and get more heat relief kits, including electrolyte drinks and instant ice packs, out to the homeless.
Even though we're used to the heat, we're not used to this type of heat. So constant and so extreme.
With human-caused climate change, these extreme events are more frequent, they come earlier, and last longer. And that doesn't bode well for wildfires either. But Grant Beebe, a director at the National Interagency Fire Center in Idaho, says the good news is fuels in higher altitude forests haven't dried out that much yet because it was a good snow year.
There's still some snowpack out there. That's great. We've got some late snow. We've got some late moistures. That's all good. That'll push the start of fire season, major fire season in the West, a little bit later.
The heat dome extends from the baking Southwest up into southern Idaho and Oregon, where temperatures could hit records in the mid-90s. Temperate for early June, if you consider tomorrow's predicted high in Furnace Creek, California, of 121. Kirk Ziegler, NPR News, Boise.
With temperatures getting dangerously high, keeping cool is increasingly costly. Forecasters predict the cost of air conditioning this season will be even higher than last year, which was the hottest summer on record. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Summer is just getting started in much of the country, but temperatures are already in the triple digits where Rosie Garcia lives in Mesa, Arizona.
There is no cooling off. I don't open the door in the evenings like I used to. My doctor says, stay out of the heat. I'm going to listen to the doctor.
Garcia, who's turning 70 this week, tries to do her errands early in the morning. Otherwise, she stays indoors. And she keeps her air conditioner running day and night.
I know I don't like that, but if I turn it off and then I get up sweating at 2 in the morning, I know I have to turn it back on. Isn't that terrible?
The electric bills for Garcia's small two-bedroom duplex run between $250 and $300 a month during the hot season, which in Arizona lasts 5 months out of the year.
I live in a fixed income. Like I said, I'm a widow and I disable. That took a chunk out of my check because I would have to pay the rent.
Garcia qualified for a federal subsidy, which helps to cover her summer cooling bills, but many people are not so lucky. Almost one out of six households around the country are behind on their utility payments, and that could get worse in the coming months. The National Weather Service is predicting a hotter-than-usual summer in most parts of the U.S. Mark Wolf, who heads an Association of State Energy Assistance Directors, predicts the average family will have to pay nearly 8% more for power this summer than they did last.
If the average temperature was 80 degrees, you didn't necessarily have to turn on the air conditioner, not very much. But now we're getting to 85, 90, 95 degree temperatures, even 100 in some cases. You have to turn it on for not just comfort level, but also for health reasons.
That's especially tough for low-income families, since energy gobbles up a larger share of their household budget. While the federal government offers people like Rosie Garcia some assistance with summer cooling cost, it's only about a quarter of what the government spends helping people pay heating bills during the winter. What's more, Wolf says the overall budget for the subsidy program was cut by $2 billion this year.
So there's an economic divide here that lower-income families are less likely to have access to adequate cooling.
Doug Hargrove runs a program that helps low-income families in South Texas pay their electric bills. He says the federal subsidy covers between 8 and 10,000 families in the area, but that's not nearly enough to go around.
The very first day that we opened in 2024, we got 52,000 phone calls. It knocked out our phone system.
Hargrove says more than 9 out of 10 families who qualified for federal assistance this year had to be turned away for lack of funds. Some got help from their local utility or other sources, but the rest have to get by as best they can, as a changing climate makes for hotter and hotter summers.
Temperatures are right around 100, but we have very high humidity. I've been almost all over the country. I don't think there's a more humid spot, not even in Florida.
That kind of heat isn't just uncomfortable, it's dangerous, especially for older people like Rosie Garcia.
You know, I've been here when it climbed to 118. I was so ill from the heat, I wouldn't even go out anymore. It gets very hot and unbearable here in Arizona. That's why we need our utilities very bad.
State energy officials are urging the federal government to set aside more money to help people pay their utility bills in the short run and to make investments that will save power in the long run. They also say no one should have their power shut off over unpaid bills during the hottest time of the year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
To tomorrow marks the 80th anniversary of the Allied landing in Normandy, France. D-Day, it was a turning point in World War II, and this year's anniversary will be attended by President Biden, also the leader of France and Canada and Germany and Ukraine, and Britain's King Charles. A few dozen surviving veterans have also made the trip, as has NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. She's been there meeting people taking part. Hey, Eleanor.
Hi, Mary Louise.
All right, tell me where exactly you are and what all you're seeing.
Oh my gosh, it's beautiful and moving, and the sights are really dramatic. You know, the American cemetery, these rows of white headstones high on the bluff above Omaha Beach. I've just come back from these rows of German bunkers with the big iron cannons pointed out to sea and amidst wheat fields. The beautiful little towns and churches, they don't seem to have changed at all. And the tiny roads through all the villages along the coast. You know, honestly, it feels like a World War II Hollywood set or a time warp. It's kind of like a festive party because thousands of people who have come here for the commemoration from all over Europe, they're dressed. Many of them are dressed as American GIs and nurses and other World War II characters in period costumes. And they're driving the vehicles of World War II, the American Jeeps and the troop carriers. It's like a festive party. It sounds kind of like this. That was today, right on the British landing beach, Gold Beach. You know, World War II era music playing, people eating grilled sausages, drinking beer, and riding all over the beach in these vintage vehicles.
Wow, such a picture. Thank you for painting it for us. Okay, so the actual anniversary is tomorrow, June 6th. What will happen?
Well, there will be very solemn and beautiful ceremonies at the American cemetery with President Biden. There'll also be ceremonies at the, you know, the British and Canadian cemeteries near their landing beaches and an international event on Omaha Beach. These images will be broadcast all over the world.
Yeah. You have been to quite a few of these D-Day commemorations over the years, Eleanor. Have they changed as time has passed?
This one is really big. You feel it. The crowds are huge. And while it's been said before that this may be the veterans' last, the men who fought here, this really does feel like it could be their last. Mary Louise, the veterans who have come back, they're 100 years old. So in 5 years, they really might not be here anymore. So that's my first thought. And secondly, you know, there was 2004 when the Germans were officially invited back. I was here. That was a big deal. And Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder came. You know, Russia has no delegation. The last time Vladimir Putin was here was in 2014. He is persona non grata today. And that's, of course, because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is on everyone's mind. You know, for decades, these commemorations were about the end of war in Europe forever, and now war has come back. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is here for the first time, and we're seeing Ukrainian flags flying amongst the Allied flags. And many people say Europe and America need to, you know, do more to help Ukraine to make sure that it has all the weapons it needs. And that was the opinion of Marco Regini, who came with a reenactment group from Italy. He was dressed in the uniform of a Scottish photographer regiment, and this is what he told me.
It's strange because the war in Ukraine has a lot of similarities with the beginning of the Second World War, a little before when Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia.
You know, he says letting Putin take part of Ukraine is very similar to that. But Mary Louise, I met other people who said they were very afraid of nuclear war and they don't believe the West should commit more help to Ukraine.
And NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, as you just heard, she's been out reporting today from the cemeteries and beaches of Normandy, France. Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from Berklee Repertory Theater, presenting Octavio Solis's Mother Road, an epic 21st century journey along Route 66, inspired by John Steinbeck, playing through July 21st. More at berkleerep.org. Sutter Health, from 34 joint replacement centers to 5 cardiovascular surgery centers, Sutter never stops helping patients get back on their feet. Learn more at sutterhealth.org.
I'm Jeff Bennett. On the next NewsHour, we travel to France to meet veterans of D-Day as they prepare to mark the 80th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy. That's Wednesday on the PBS NewsHour.
We'll take you to the beaches of Normandy, other news across the country and the world on the PBS NewsHour on KQBD at 3 today, then at 4.
Seasonal adjustment. It's a term that's thrown around constantly by analysts and economists. What, though, does that actually mean?
There were a lot of people who were hired for the Christmas holiday season, and those were temporary jobs, and they're gone in January.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Seasonal changes in this economy next time on Marketplace.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, an attempt to recall a conservative school board president in the Riverside County city of Temecula seems to be succeeding. It's been a battle over issues also playing out nationally, like the rights of parents versus transgender kids and banning pride flags and books with references to LGBTQ history. We'll talk about the implications for a similar recall happening here in the Bay Area. It's Political Breakdown today at 5:50 on KQED Radio.
Support for NPR comes from USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses avoid shipping challenges with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage. Your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services. yptc.com/NPR. And by the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In 1972, it was a bold, innovative idea, a U.S. government program that paid a guaranteed monthly income. Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, sent checks to some of the poorest disabled and elderly to help them pay for rent, food, and other expenses, to lift them up from poverty. But our reporting found that today, the program traps people in poverty instead. NPR investigative correspondent Joseph Shapiro tells us about this forgotten safety net.
One of the biggest traps is Supplemental Security Income's limit on how much you can own. $2,000. That's it. If you have a dollar more than that in savings or possessions, other than one car or your own home, you get kicked off the program. That $2,000 limit, it hasn't been changed since 1989. It's pretty hard to stay under that $2,000 limit on assets, which was clear on a visit to the Terry Funeral Home. It's been a fixture in West Philadelphia, serving generations of black families. Amen. And today, as one funeral service ends, Karen Williams has come to tell the funeral director about a problem.
How are you? God bless.
She's been trying to do the responsible thing and save money to pay for her own funeral one day. But that federal assistance program says she can't.
Yeah, right? So, Lord. We see that all the time.
Gregory Burrell, the funeral home director, is familiar with the problem.
And unfortunately, people don't know any better, and they're stressing, and these insurance policies are considered assets.
That's what got Karen Williams into trouble with the federal government. Williams is disabled. She doesn't work. For income, she depends upon SSI. People who get SSI are required to report everything they own to Social Security, which runs the program, and let the agency monitor their bank accounts and collect income data. Williams reported her checking account. She didn't know her life insurance policy counted. She bought it so her kids wouldn't need to pay for her burial to use after she died. She didn't know the policy had a modest cash value, that she could turn it in for $1,900.
I would have definitely went by the rules. I didn't know I was breaking them.
Until the day in 2019 when she got a letter from Social Security telling her, you need to come to our office. That's where a staffer told her Social Security found records of that insurance policy, plus the couple hundred dollars she'd saved in the bank. As a result, she'd gone over the asset limit, by $160 and had been for the last 2 years.
They come to me several years later and say, "Ooh, you owe $20,000.
That's right. For going $160 over the limit, she now owed $20,385 because Social Security was counting all the SSI checks it sent her in the 2 years she'd been over the limit and demanding all of that money back, even though Social Security only discovered the problem now and she had 30 days to pay it back, which was impossible. She's poor. She depends upon SSI, an assistance program that said she couldn't save more than the $2,000 asset limit.
The impact of it is just cruel.
Kathleen Romig recently went to work as a senior advisor to the Commissioner of Social Security. She works on making programs like SSI more fair to children. When we interviewed her last year, she wasn't speaking for Social Security. She worked at a Washington think tank, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she wrote about raising the asset limit or ending it altogether because it stops people from saving.
We know that saving is good. We know that we can use savings to invest in things that can make people's lives better, like, for example, education or safe and stable housing. We know that saving is necessary for that. And yet we're prohibiting some of the poorest, most vulnerable people from doing just that.
That $2,000 asset limit traps people on SSI in poverty. Some 7.5 million people rely on SSI.
SSI is stuck in the past. It's hardly been changed over 50 years.
Like that asset limit. Since SSI started in 1972, it's been increased just once.
If the resource limit in SSI had been updated, simply for inflation over the last 50 years, it would be $10,000 now.
Last year, a group of Democratic and Republican lawmakers, led by Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, introduced legislation to increase the limit to $10,000.
The government shouldn't punish people for wanting to do the right thing and save money by taking away the benefits they rely on to live.
But the bill stalled, largely because of cost. We heard of dozens of cases from SSI recipients and their lawyers of people disabled, eligible, and in need who were denied SSI or cut off of SSI benefits because they went over that low $2,000 asset limit. A New York man told us about going to the Social Security office and being denied because he owned a worthless timeshare in the Poconos.
That's what I was told by my caseworker there. Don't even, because you still have the timeshare, you're ineligible, period. Have a nice day.
Peter Belletti tried to sell it without success because he owned it with his ex-wife. But to Social Security, it was an asset that put him over that $2,000 limit on how much he could own. Another man told us he wanted to move from an unsafe and rundown apartment, but when he saved up for the deposit and rent on a new place, Social Security said he was over the asset limit and would get kicked off SSI. An immigrant mother co-signed a car loan for her son and then lost her SSI, even though she never uses the car. A Virginia Holocaust survivor received a reparations check from Germany and was told, improperly it turned out, that he couldn't keep the check and his SSI too. Back at the funeral home.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Makes me to lie down. And
Gregory Burrell, the funeral director, and Karen Williams talk of how past generations of black families had little access to saving, but their parents and grandparents put aside money to pay for their funerals.
And every week or 2 weeks, whenever the insurance guy came, he would mark the book and take the money out.
With the little book, that brings back memories.
Yeah. Man, it was probably 50 cents a week, but they had it.
For Karen Williams, it was embarrassing when she lost her SSI checks. She got by with help from her children and friends. She found a lawyer at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia who helped her challenge the big bill she got from SSI. Recently, Social Security put her back on SSI and conceded it made a mistake and would waive the money she owed, but then still deducted thousands of dollars from her checks. She's still fighting SSI.
It's really tiresome. I am so through with this. And I can believe that a lot of people just give up.
She's correct. The system is filled with mistakes. And Social Security's own numbers show that fewer and fewer people are even applying for those monthly supplemental security income benefits. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for KQED Today comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. And by Canyon Ranch Woodside, inviting guests to find their path to well-being at its retreat in the Redwoods, minutes south of San Francisco. Weekend packages available. Visit canyonranch.com for more info. Here's what's ahead in 30 minutes.
In Japan, there's an advertising campaign that makes doting fathers look cool. In a country where the population is shrinking rapidly, can the trend be reversed by getting dads more involved? That story and more global news next time on The World.
The latest global news stories and more at the top of the hour. Good afternoon. I'm Dave Freeman on KQED Public Radio. The time right now is 1:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When the U.S. military conducts war games, service members sometimes crowd around a table with giant maps.
It's 2030. You are the current leadership of the Coast Guard, and you are writing the strategy. It's supposed to be for the next 20 years for the Coast Guard.
Hear about the new adversary in the games after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Former President Trump's trial on charges of mishandling classified documents has likely been further delayed. NPR's Greg Allen tells us Judge Eileen Cannon has set a hearing to discuss prosecutors' request that she order Trump to not make disparaging comments that could endanger FBI agents.
Judge Cannon says the hearing will happen later this month and has postponed a previously scheduled hearing. The new schedule increases the likelihood that Trump's trial on charges of withholding and concealing classified documents, originally scheduled for May, will not take place before the election. Special Counsel Jack Smith asked for the order after Trump stated in social media posts and fundraising emails that when the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago, it, quote, was authorized to shoot me and was just itching to do the unthinkable. Prosecutors say that rhetoric invites threats and harassment of potential witnesses. Trump says a gag order would violate his First Amendment rights. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
The leader of Wales, a semi-autonomous part of the United Kingdom, has lost a vote of confidence, but that vote was non-binding, and he's vowed not to step down, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Vaughn Gething is a Zambian-born lawyer who earlier this year became the first black head of any government in Europe. Since then, he's been dogged by questions, though, about a campaign donation and his handling of COVID-19 in his previous role as the Welsh Health Minister. Gething denies any wrongdoing, but this could hurt his Labour Party, which is leading polls ahead of the wider UK election July 4th.
NPR's Lauren Freyer. Gething made history in March when he was elected to head the Welsh administration. During his election campaign, he faced criticism for accepting donations from a recycling company whose owner was convicted of breaking environmental and safety regulations. Well, stocks finished solidly higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR. 3 weeks after he was seriously wounded in an assassination attempt, Slovakia's prime minister has been seen publicly for the first time on social media. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
Left-wing populist Prime Minister Robert Fico published a video of himself on his Facebook page saying that the attack had, quote, seriously damaged his health and that it would be a small miracle if he can go back to work in a few weeks. The video is Fico's first public statement since he was shot several times in an assassination attempt 3 weeks ago while greeting supporters in the central Slovakian town of Handlova. The suspected gunman was arrested at the scene. Fico said he hopes to return to work in late June or early July, and he said he forgives his attacker. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Well, the third time was a charm today for the successful launch of Boeing Starliner space capsule, now on its way to the International Space Station. Two NASA astronauts are on board conducting a critical first test flight of the capsule after years of delays for the program. Boeing has lagged far behind its commercial counterpart, SpaceX, which has already flown 9 missions for NASA. The space agency plans eventually to split astronaut flights between the two companies, with trips to the space station at least twice a year. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher across the board today. The Dow up 96 points, or 0.25%. This is NPR.
Afternoon support for KQED today comes from Comcast Business. When choosing Comcast Business Internet, customers are choosing a next-generation 10G network to help keep their business future ready. Comcast Business, powering possibilities, restrictions apply. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We can arrange to have it picked up running or not in most cases and invest the funds back into our news coverage. More at kqed.org/cars. More heat this afternoon in the Bay Area. Look for high temperatures today, low 70s up to the low 100s far inland. Very hot, Sacramento Valley, highs 100 to 105 this afternoon. Overnight lows 62 to 72, sunny, warm to hot again tomorrow. Support for NPR comes from Ooma, cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At ooma.com/NPR. And by Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And by the listeners and members of KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The U.S. Agency for International Development, better known as USAID, says it is sending $90 million to aid Palestinians in Gaza. The announcement comes amid growing concerns of famine. Roughly half the population of Gaza faces severe food insecurity. Well, Samantha Power is in charge. She is the administrator for USAID. Samantha Power, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Good to be back.
What are you hoping $90 million will buy?
Well, it will buy a lot more if we can secure greater humanitarian access, because resources are only part of the equation. It is really important that every country step up. There are a lot of needs in places like Sudan all around the world. And so this is an important announcement. It allows organizations like the World Food Program, UNICEF, and others to build their pipelines to get supplies into the region. But fundamentally, we need more checkpoints open. We need humanitarian aid workers to feel secure as they drive from one part of Gaza to the next. And that's been very challenging throughout this conflict so far.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on a key thing, which is that providing aid is one thing, getting it distributed is another, especially since the closing of the Rafah border crossing, and there's been damage to the pier the U.S. has been working on building. How does that effort go, getting the aid this money will hopefully buy to people who desperately need it?
Well, I think that you mentioned Rafah. Rafah needs to be reopened. It's very important. Negotiations between Egypt and Israel are underway. I think President Biden did something extremely important, which is broker the reopening of Kerem Shalom. And we now have, 200, 300 trucks most days going through Kerem Shalom. But, we've said that we need 500 trucks, humanitarian aid trucks alone. And that's something we've been saying for many months, and it's a target that we've almost never met. So you can imagine the deficit between, getting to 150, 250 trucks and 500. And trucks are a poor proxy for what we're really talking about, but it's basic shelter, food, medicine, and now with the fuel shortages, water as well, because it's so difficult to power the water in the sanitation plants.
You're talking about things that the U.S. has been calling for months. You're an experienced diplomat, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Is the U.S. doing everything it can, exerting every ounce of leverage it has to try to get this aid to the people it needs?
Well, we are pushing, I can tell you, relentlessly, and USAID's logisticians and operational people are on the ground coming up day in, day out with creative solutions. But clearly, Hamas, you know, insinuates itself in the civilian population. That makes it very, very challenging. Mm. And Israel needs to prioritize the opening of multiple crossing points at, you know, at one time. I think the emphasis right now, honestly, Mary Louise, is on this really important ceasefire proposal, because what the president has laid out is something that would pause the fighting, you know, it would address some of these concerns that aid workers have about moving around, not just their safety, but the delays and the blockages at checkpoints and so forth. You know, all of that presumably would melt away, and we would be able to flood the zone with the kinds of food and shelter that are needed. And as President Biden has said, pave the way for a permanent end of hostilities, because this just can't go on.
Just to change gears, I do want to ask about growing dissent within the Biden administration over the administration's policy toward Gaza. I have interviewed one of the State Department officials who resigned in protest, and I know one of your senior advisors, Alex Smith, resigned last week. In his resignation letter to you, he, quote, wrote, "I can no longer in good conscience continue to be silent amidst USAID's de facto policy of ignoring human suffering when that suffering is perpetrated by an ally." How do you respond to that?
Well, nobody at USAID, I assure you, is ignoring human suffering. And I wish I could have on the show the people who do this work day in, day out, often at great personal risk. I wish I could introduce you indeed to our Palestinian staff, you know, who are doing this work and who have family members in Gaza for whom this is really, really personal. We have a lot of views at USAID that are critical of U.S. foreign policy. We have views that believe we are pushing and doing everything we can. And my job is to hear those views, and particularly those that are informed by facts on the ground and ideas about what more we can do, because the situation is abhorrent. Civilians are living in unimaginable terror and in unimaginable deprivation. So if there weren't people, particularly at an agency like USAID that is rooted in humanitarian and development mission, who are unhappy about where we are, I that would be disappointing in its own right.
That is Samantha Power. She is the U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator. I appreciate your time. I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
History was made today at Cape Canaveral in Florida. Boeing Starliner space capsule lifted off with its first ever human crew. This launch is years behind schedule, plagued by engineering and technical issues. But now that it is safely in space, this critical test flight is key to NASA's efforts to help transport astronauts to and from the International Space Station, as Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne explains.
It took three tries, but finally NASA astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams launched atop an Atlas V rocket, taking Boeing's space capsule on its maiden flight with people.
3, 2, 1, ignition, and liftoff of Starliner and Atlas V, carrying two American heroes, drawing a line to the stars for all of us.
It's not the crew's first mission. The two are seasoned NASA astronauts who have worked on the space station before, and they're excited to return to their orbital home away from home. But this trip will be no joyride for them, says their boss, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson.
Now, Butch and Sonny do what they do best. They're test pilots. And they're going to test this thing from izzard to gizzard.
One minor issue has popped up already. Starliner's cooling system used more water than anticipated. There's a backup, and engineers say this is why they test. And that includes evaluating the environmental control system and displays in the spacecraft. While Starliner can essentially fly by itself, the astronauts will manually fly the spacecraft as it approaches the space station tomorrow. Boeing's Mark Nappe says while today's launch was a critical step in this test mission,
launch is just the first part of this. We now have to get to ISS. We have to dock. We have to do docking ops. We have to undock. We have to do reentry, and we have to land.
The program is vital for NASA to ferry astronauts to the space station. After the space shuttle retired in 2011, NASA teamed up with Boeing and SpaceX to provide astronaut transport. SpaceX completed its crewed spaceflight mission 4 years ago, and since then has flown 8 additional missions for NASA. If Starliner is certified after this flight, NASA would then have 2 providers, allowing the agency to rotate launches between SpaceX and Boeing.
And it's important to have 2.
Laura Forsick is a space industry analyst and executive director of Astrolytical.
And so if you
have a problem with one of the vehicles, you need to make sure you have another system flying. And that's what this is. This is another system flying.
Once Wilmore and Williams dock with the station, they'll join seven other crew members. Space Station Manager Joel Montalbano says he made sure they're ready for visitors.
I said, hey, you know, turn the porch light on, print out the Wi-Fi password, and set the table for two more for dinner.
It'll be a quick trip for the Starliner crew, about a week before having to say goodbye and return home under a canopy of parachutes in the southwest U.S. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne at the Kennedy Space Center.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's a new dawn for South African politics after the long-governing African National Congress, or ANC, took a bashing in last week's elections and lost its parliamentary majority for the first time. Kate Bartlett reports the party is now in frantic talks to form a coalition with only just over a week left to do so.
Winter kicked in this week and a cold front brought some rare snow to parts of South Africa. In scenes like this, delighted children played in the snow. With their trademark humor, South Africans responded by sending around a meme reading. The coldest place in South Africa last night, Luthuli House, minus 71. Luthuli House is the headquarters of the ANC. And 71 is the number of parliamentary seats they lost in last week's elections.
Nicholas and Howick, hi, the elections.
Hi, Stephen, how are you?
But well, jokes aside, South Africans are on edge as parties enter coalition talks, anxious to see what form a new government might take after 30 years of ANC dominance.
There's all the speculation who they're going to be coalitions with.
Local talk radio, newspapers and social media are all abuzz with speculation on whether the ANC will do a deal with the centrist business-friendly Democratic Alliance, or DA, which won the second largest share of the vote. But it has an optics problem.
Many in the ANC and public perceptions are that the DA essentially tries to promote white interests. It might not be true, but that's a public perception that's out there.
That's Kia Leboga Mofune, Professor of African Politics at the University of South Africa. Another coalition option is for the ANC to join with the radical left-wing Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF. The EFF wants land expropriation without compensation and the nationalization of mines and banks. And the worry is they will scare investors. Impunye again.
The downside for the EFF, it is seen as this highly militant, active party, especially in terms of the fact that when it comes to the markets, because of its leftist stance around nationalization and so on.
And South Africa needs investment. Despite being Africa's most developed economy, it has some of the world's highest unemployment rates. The ANC accepted the outcome of last week's vote, saying it showed the strength of South Africa's democracy. But not everyone agrees.
The results are not correct. And I'm hoping whoever is responsible is hearing what we are saying. Don't start trouble when there is no trouble.
Jacob Zuma, a disgruntled former president with a criminal record, making false claims about election rigging. His newly formed Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK party, came a surprise third in the polls. The MK refuses to go into a coalition with the ANC's Cyril Ramaphosa as president. The ANC says Ramaphosa staying on is non-negotiable. ANC spokesperson Malengi Bengu Motsiri stressed that all options were still on the table. The latest talk is of a government of national unity. By law, a government must be formed within 2 weeks of election results, so time is running out. South Africa is in uncharted territory, and whatever comes next will have an immense impact on its future. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from Style Bath and Kitchen, a locally owned business bringing tailored kitchens and bathrooms to life for over 25 years. With brands such as Toto and California Faucets, listeners can learn more by searching Style Bath and Kitchen online. And UCSF Health, advancing heart and vascular conditions require specialized care. Welcome to the heart of expertise. Learn more at ucsfhealth.org.
Healthcare is a top priority for voters in the upcoming election.
It's important to note that Latinos have essentially had the lowest access to both health insurance and healthcare among any racial and ethnic group in the country over the last 10 years or so.
Our series, We the Voters, continues with a focus on healthcare and the uninsured. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Don't miss Morning Edition tomorrow, 2 a.m. until 9, and then join us tomorrow morning after Morning Edition for Forum.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, driverless taxis have become a common sight in San Francisco, even a tourist attraction. But their learning models and the traffic scenarios that confound them have remained a blind spot for California regulators. From long-haul trucking to package delivery, and yes, those Waymo cars, we're talking about autonomous vehicles. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
I'm Leslie McClurg, in for Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., Ruth Whitman is a feminist writer. She's also the mother of three sons. Her new book, Boy Mom, asks how to raise good men in an age where people on the right weaponize male concerns and people on the left dismiss them. We'll hear about her reporting and her own experiences as a boy mom. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
On a Wednesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The military regularly conducts war games, sometimes with real ships and tanks, but also sometimes just a map around a table. Very recently, though, a new adversary has shown up in those games, climate change. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
So let's go over this board.
At a base in Portsmouth, Virginia, two dozen Coast Guard service members, Coasties, recently gathered around tables with poker chips, dice, and two giant world maps.
Please place them where, you know, based on your vision and strategy.
They put their chips on the priorities they think the Coast Guard should bet on for the next few decades.
Let's get our strategy and vision on the board.
The players wear civilian clothes so no one knows what rank anyone is. That's to make for a better dialogue. In the same spirit, the Coast Guard allowed NPR to record only if the players could be anonymous. We can identify Michelle Ziegler, one of the game masters. She's with the RAND Corporation.
It's 2030. You are the current leadership of the Coast Guard, and you are writing the strategy that's supposed to be for the next 20 years for the Coast Guard.
In the game, 2030 looks like this. Relations with China are good, but Russia is strong. It won the war in Ukraine and is still at odds with the West. And so much polar ice has melted that the Arctic is open. Ziegler says that means a new shipping route from China to Europe along the northern coast of Russia.
Which is bringing more commerce in the area, more activity, also more potential for tensions.
And that's what's new about this edition of the game. Along with geopolitical forces, climate change is an adversary. It's causing migration from heat and drought in Central America. Fishing boats have to go further out for their catch. Hurricanes are so big now they need a new number, Category 6.
Increased storm activity in the Pacific Northwest includes a rare West Coast typhoon that hits...
Zachary Schulman, a Coast Guard analyst, reads out future news headlines after each turn.
Sending a large number of recreational boaters fleeing for safety at the same time that the Coast Guard is being called upon to respond to damage and hazards throughout the Puget Sound area.
As the teams react and plan and find out if they invested well, they roll the dice to add a bit of unpredictability.
Over three.
Six.
And Schulman keeps announcing new events that complicate things.
A Russian commercial enterprise in the Arctic breaks a set of undersea cables while dragging the seabed for minerals, and several Arctic nations respond aggressively. Not sure if the Russian action was deliberate or not. The U.S. Navy responds.
The Coasties take it in stride. They've been seeing the effects of climate change already on their work. But putting those factors into this exercise was a battle of its own, says Michelle Ziegler.
We had started these under and built these scenarios under the previous administration. And at that time, it was, you know, the words climate change were being removed from government websites, right? So that's in a very different era, in a very different world. And so now we need to do what we can to catch up.
The Biden administration has a Pentagon-wide policy to plan for rising seas and hotter weather and to cut emissions. That could all change with the next election. Just last month, Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro was in a Senate hearing where Republicans told him he has his priorities backward.
One of the things you've actually been focused on a lot on is climate change, where in your nomination hearing, you devoted a full paragraph on climate change. You never mentioned shipbuilding, lethality, or war fighting.
That was Alaska's Dan Sullivan and later Missouri Senator Eric Schmidt.
Do you believe that climate change is a bigger threat to the American people than communist China's ambitions?
They're different.
Do you believe that climate change is a bigger threat to the American people than a nuclear holocaust?
Of course not.
Okay.
Many scientists do consider global warming as a threat to humanity on par with nuclear war. Critics say the military sees the threats mostly through a tactical lens. Anatole Levin is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
If Russian ships can sail a bit further north than they used to be, well, who cares? That doesn't mean they can invade Canada.
Levin thinks conflicts with China and Russia at this point are less dangerous than climate points of no return, like melting glaciers and permafrost.
These are the threats to not just the United States, but modern civilization in general.
You roll.
Yes.
You are rolling from this one. Who wants to roll here?
Cutting emissions and rolling back global warming were not part of the game being played at the Coast Guard base, but it did bring home the realities of the not-too-distant future.
Halifax will be underwater.
That's some dark humor about coastal bases threatened by rising sea levels, including the many right here in Hampton Roads, Virginia, where this game was played.
And the regions that we
humor aside, when that and other climate threats get severe, these coasties will have tried out a few solutions, at least in the game.
I think overall we did pretty well.
Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Portsmouth, Virginia.
In rural North Carolina, a research farm grows new blueberry varieties for gardeners and farmers alike. And the berries, well, they have to be harvested. Reporter Kelly Kenoyer from member station WHQR went along on a recent picking.
So excited I didn't bring my bucket.
About 30 people gather near a blueberry field to listen to researcher Bill Klein. He offers the best technique for gathering the fruit.
Attach the bucket so that you have both hands free to pick. Just cup your hands, roll them off with your thumbs, and down into the bucket.
This research farm is part of North Carolina State University, and the fruit isn't sold, it's donated. And these volunteers are here to help.
And you might get to take a blueberry or two home at the end of the deal. So really appreciate you being out here.
In the field, I start picking next to Ellen Bonzak, a master gardener from Pender County.
Are you excited about getting to eat them while you pick them?
I was going
to
wait so people wouldn't see me, you know. Shoving it down my neck here.
I think we all know what this is about.
Bonzak is one of a group of master gardeners picking today. To them, the research farm is a unique opportunity to learn. As the buckets fill with blueberries, Klein brings out more boxes for transport to the food bank.
They make a great sound going in the box.
They really do.
Oh, yeah, they do.
They are the largest blueberries I've ever seen. Klein says this variety is called Pinnacle. It can grow to the size of a quarter.
It is not widely planted. It's not a real high yielder, but what it does have is exceptional flavor and size.
On this 50-acre farm, there are thousands of bushes of different varieties being tested at any time. Klein says it's a big effort to find a new breed with the ideal traits of climate adaptability, disease resistance, yield, and flavor.
It takes a lot of time and patience to develop.
Blueberries aren't typically sold under a named variety like apples are. Instead, the kind we find in stores changes every 3 or 4 weeks as each planting completes its harvest, starting from Florida and going up to Maine. Regardless of the type, there's nothing like eating berries right off the bush, warmed by the sun.
How are they?
Very delicious.
Good.
Would you like to try one?
Oh, I have. Don't worry.
For NPR News, I'm Kelly Kenoyer in Castlehaine, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR this afternoon comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port, and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, whose scientists work to lay the foundation of CDK4/6 inhibitors, which are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. DanaFarber.org/everywhere. And the listeners and supporters of KQED Public Radio. Join us for The World coming up in